Hello, this is Informer, a show that reveals the latest ideas from artists, thinkers, and technologists. Informer invites you behind the screen to meet the people sketching, hacking, and imagining the next versions of our world. I'm Roddy Schrock, your host, and in each episode, I spotlight creative minds grappling with a changing world through art, technology, or often both. And I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast at informerpodcast.com, where you can also find show notes, links, and more information on all of the artists and projects that we discuss. So I have had a long-standing interest in the ways in which policy, bureaus, and myriad forms of governmental departments and interventions nurture the complex ecologies of local and national cultural institutions, thereby influencing the material realities for working artists. It's a complex dance, and I was very excited when Gonzalo Casals took the lead here in New York as head of the Department of Cultural Affairs. And as he points out, his first day was March 11th, 2020, the exact date most people pin to the beginning of the global crisis. I've known him for a number of years, since his time at the High Line, where he was creating very forward-looking public art programs. His philosophy of building cultural democracy, which he explains in our conversation, is quietly radical, particularly in a city like New York, which has spent most of the last 20 years placing its bets on the draw of high-profile legacy institutions. It seems to me that Gonzalo is working to draw a new map of interdependence for the arts and artists in New York, and I appreciate that work. I began our conversation by asking him what his earliest memories of art were.
I was very impacted by an experience that I saw back home. It clearly marked the way I look at arts and culture throughout my whole career. The context of that experience is that I was born in the midst of a military dictatorship, probably one of the most brutal in the history of the country and Latin America, with 30,000 people being disappeared. That's how we would call it, right? Being just kidnapped and killed by the military government. And 82, it was decided that we were going to, 82, 83, that we were going to transition back to democracy. So from an early age, I sort of like, I was able to see the challenges and opportunities of a young democracy. And in particular, that experience that I'm talking to you is a project that is called the El Partenón de Libros, which is a Parthenon made out of books by Marta Minujín, in which she created she sort of rebuilt the Parthenon scale 1-to-1 with a scaffolding structure. And then the structure had books attached in sort of like what you would say Ziploc bags. Each book was on a different bag attached to the structure. The structure was all covered in books. And these books happened to be books that had been banned by the dictatorship. Books that have been, you know, literally sort of like put under the ground, just, you know, of fear of being, you know, found, you know, with those books, and books that had been, you know, in basements and just sort of hidden because of the dictatorship. And the most beautiful thing about that project is after being exhibited in a public park for at the very center of the city for 2 weeks, the people were invited to come in, climb into the structure, grab books, and take them with them home. And to this day, I was like 9, 10 years old when I saw that. And to this day, I get goosebumps every time I remember that that moment that I experienced. And I think that's really sort of what marked my whole career and life.
I can see the lines that might be drawn from that work in particular in your approach to arts and cultural leadership throughout your career. And maybe you could share a little bit what led you into the position you're in now in terms of moves that you made since that time that you were so deeply impacted by that experience.
There are two ways to tell the story. You know, one way is at a high level, I was always interested in three things in my career, right? And they all appear somewhat in parallel with one taking over the other one at different moments. One is the practice. I consider myself a cultural producer, you know, programming and just working with artists to sort of realize their vision, mostly in sort of participatory public settings. Two is I found that the only way, and probably you can relate to this, the only way that one can find in this career a moment to reflect is by teaching, right? I always thought that being in the classroom, and I always think, you know, learning happens in a group setting, right? So being in a classroom, discussing ideas, sharing what you have learned doing that practice, it's extremely valuable for us to have the time to reflect and to think, you know, where are the next ways of doing things. And then the third one, which I always do it through the advocacy work that I have been doing on the side, complementing, you know, the other two activities, is sort of the policy making, right? And the policy setting, which with this job has completely taken over, you know, my life. But you always have those three connecting threads going through my career. I did start here when I came to New York and landed in Jackson Heights, Queens, which is still where I'm talking to you. I've been in this neighborhood for almost 20 years. One of the biggest secrets is Jackson Heights, historically, since the 60s, Jackson Heights has been the second largest concentration of gay men in the city, with a huge percentage of these gay men being recently arriving immigrants. And if you go back to 2001, 2002, smartphones were just coming out, you know, and they were just happening. There was no social media, no dating apps. With a friend of mine, we realized that the only opportunities that gay community in Jackson Heights had to connect one another was the bar scene. So we decided to create a monthly film series in which we'll show films with LGBTQ content by LGBTQ filmmakers and actors, and then use that as an excuse, as a sort of a build social capital and build a community around that. That led me to then, you know, work at El Museo del Barrio and just move from, you know, cultural strategies, you know, for a very specific group of people in a very specific neighborhood to something that is more culturally specific across the city, if not the nation. Then probably that's when you and I met, the High Line, in which the challenge was sort of like, it seems, Gonzalo, that you know how to deal with communities and how to, you know, sort of build audiences.
What would you say, if you had to summarize, what is the particular value of that kind of practice?
If you were to tag this conversation, would be under the idea of a cultural democracy, right? A democracy in which you not only have access to your culture, but you have access to have some agency. You know, how do you, in creating, you know, those cultural experiences? There were like four or five ideas that started probably in a very intuitive way with Cinema Rosa, which was the program at Jackson Heights, that then went on to be hosted by the Queens Museum, but also became very clear at El Museo del Barrio. And then the idea was like, how do we move these ideas from what you would call a culturally specific museum into a mainstream organization like the High Line? And the first one is the idea of cultural empowerment, right? How important is to see yourself reflected in society, right? And how alienating is when you don't see yourself reflected in society, right? When you grow up and you don't have access to gay role models as a queer person, right? When you grow up and there's no people of color on the stories that you see on the television and movies, you know, the books that you read, you name it, or even the history that you learn, right? Then there's another component about the cultural understanding, in which not only arts and culture experiences could be a mirror to yourself and to communities, but it could also be a window to the other, right? How we can use, and artists are really good at this, of creating opportunities for us to have conversations, to start understanding, you know, the rapid changes that are happening in our society. The third one is once you feel empowered and you feel connected, you know, what are the opportunities for you to connect to other people that has similar values and similar ideas? And it's the idea of social capital, right? The value that exists in relationships that you and I could create, right? Each of us have our own human capital. Extremely capitalistic idea, but very important to understand, right? And then, you know, when we meet, that connection creates another set of value. And then to me, it was important. So once you feel empowered, once you are connected and you feel like you're part of a larger thing, what's your responsibility towards that community, right? And the idea of civic participation, civic engagement, that has been largely explored in arts and culture, but without the other components, you know, sometimes you feel that you don't have the connection to that. And then at the end of all this is the idea of belonging, right? Which is what we're trying to do at the Highland. How can you, by giving you agency on deciding, you know, the experiences that you have in that public park, how you start feeling that, you know, you belong to that place?
And bringing that now to your current role, is this something that you find any resistance around that very clear philosophy that you laid out about cultural practice?
Not at all. And for a couple of reasons. One is my predecessor, Tom Finkerpel, who has been amazing in the last 6 years prior to me coming to the agency on really installing the conversation, right? He's the one that got a little bit, I wouldn't say pushback, but a little bit of anxiety in the sector when he says, you know, we're going to sort of measure how diverse our workforce looks like, right? And the results didn't surprise anyone, but it was the first time that the government was, we're going to look at this seriously. So after 6 years of Tom really sort of bringing everybody along into that journey that he had started back in the Queen's Museum, and there was no pushback, but also in the context of you know, the pandemic, once again the mainstream reckoning, you know, of social and racial injustice in our society. So I don't think there's anyone at this moment in the cultural sector in New York City that says this work is not important. Right. There are different levels, but then the work needs to happen.
I would just love to hear from you a little bit, you know, now that we're going into kind of the end of a period. And one of the reasons I was really excited to talk to you is I do get the sense that we're in a bit of a transition moment as we come to the elections this year. I would love to just hear from you anything that you want to share around what it's been like to be in your role and what you've seen change, or have you even had time to kind of map the kinds of radical shifts that you've seen sort of occur in the cultural fabric of the city?
You know, a couple of things. One is that I took this position, and my position was actually announced on March 11, 2020. March 13 is when we all decided to close. I was running Les Lohman Museum, and many of us decided we need to close our cultural organizations, the city getting shut down the week after that. Right. So I didn't know what I was getting into. And actually, my concern of taking this job is, like, I always like to take jobs that have a challenge. I was like, Tom did almost everything, right? You know, am I going to be a lame commissioner coming in, you know, in the last 2 years of the administration to do what? Be careful what you ask for. What was interesting is, and I don't want to sound naive, you see probably what I struggle the most is to see how you have to make decisions that are 10,000 feet, you know, view, having been always, you know, where the rubber hits the road, right? And, you know, like how you also have to make priorities, right? You know, like your decisions that you're making are not necessarily about the cultural sector anymore. You're just part of a group and making decisions about the whole city. And I can give you examples of that. I think, you know, the opportunity was interesting because I was able to show that the agency could be so much more than a public funder, right? We're very proud to be the largest municipal funder in the country. And by far, we're almost at the same level or higher than the federal government. But there were opportunities and there were challenges that came along the way that you couldn't throw just money into it to solve it, right? Sort of the opportunity to be an advocate and create the tools that the cultural sector would need to create advocacy, from surveys to data collection to you name it, but also being not only a platform to be the voice of the sector and just sort of like say, we're here to help, but also we need help, but also convening, right? I think there was something that amazing that happened between advocacy, between the sector, between the city council, between the administration, in particular the Department of Cultural Affairs, is that while we all continue to understand our roles in this sort of game that we're all playing, at the same time, we came together and it was very clear that we all have the same objectives and that that each of us from our perspectives we needed and our roles, we needed to push forward for the recovery.
Do you have a sense of anything that you hoped to achieve during your tenure that you were not able to achieve because of circumstances?
You know, I usually come to my jobs understanding what the challenge is. In this case, the challenge changed completely, but also very open to understand, you know, like just get in, understand what's going on, and then figure out, you know, what's possible and where things should be taken. The one of the main mandates that as I was talking to the deputy mayor and the mayor was, we want to leave agencies in a better place than that we left them, right? And it's not like sort of internally, but also externally. And there were like three things that are very high level and that somewhat we're able to create change. One is improve the infrastructure and the situation of the agency. We sort of reorganize the percent for art unit to be, so the city could have a decent public art unit, you know, just with monuments and, you know, public art being so much at the center of many conversations about equity in our cities. We were able to add more staffing. We're just sort of restructuring some things, computers, you name it, you know, a lot of, you know, really boring stuff that but makes the agency more efficient in order to support the sector. And then we wanted to help the sector recover. And in doing that, we want to help the city recover.
What were some things that surprised you the most about being commissioner?
You know, it's surprising to, first of all, you feel a little bit of imposter syndrome, right? You know, like really, you know, an immigrant from South America is going to be in charge of arts and culture in New York City, which makes complete sense after you think about it, right? And when people tell me, you know, like this was probably the worst moment to take this job, you know, I look back and I said, you know, I don't know if I would have wanted to be doing anything else than really being in a position of leadership, in a platform like this, to help the sector that was so generous to me when I came 20 years ago and for my whole career. I think the surprise is, you know, again, how you would think that, you know, the way the city is being run is an extremely sophisticated system. And it's actually, it's a whole bunch of people working really hard to make it work. And such a complicated city with so many complications in bureaucracy and precedents and you name it.
It just reminds me of this quip that I remember from years ago that, you know, an institution is really just a group of people. And you saying that just really resonates with me on that level. What do you think is the thing that you would change the most about the way the cultural sector functions in New York?
You know, it's not as much about how the cultural sector functions. I think, you know, there are two things, internally within the sector and externally. Internally within the sector, I want to warn us all that while yes, we're extremely resilient as a sector, and we prove it once again, you know, through the pandemic, and we're proving it now, and there's a sense of pride that comes of that, you know, like that shouldn't be our normal MO. And, right. And really, you know, make a case. We already, the cultural sector came into the pandemic in a very precarious situation, right? And that should not be the normal or the new normal. From how much we pay our employees to how much we pay our artists, you know, how many resources we have in general to do the work that we do, right? But again, you know, how do we make sure that we come back in a much more sustainable way? So that's internally. And externally is, I'm still fascinated by two situations that oppose each other. And, you know, how do we solve this problem? On one way, when we were doing the cultural plan back in 2017 with Tom as commissioner, we found out that 96% of New Yorkers believe that arts and culture is something essential in their everyday life, which is great. When you do the same survey at the peak of the pandemic last year, at the peak of the pandemic in New York, right? When we were the epicenter of the pandemic, the number goes down for 10 points only to 86. Which is fascinating. And if you compare it to a national level, you know, it's 50 on normal times and 40 or 51, I think, and 41, you know, during the pandemic. So there is a sense by all New Yorkers that, you know, arts and culture is something important. At the same time, and I found that through my career, but it became much more evident as I work at the city level, is how hard it's still for us to make people understand, you know, how essential we are to the life of the city. And it's not only just the economic development opportunities that we present, it's not only the social impact that we present, it's like, you know, we're just part of the identity of New Yorkers. Those two are tied together. I think until we don't start thinking that we deserve more and we need to be less resilient and more sustainable, we won't be able to make a case for everybody else around us that we need support.
One of the great things I've seen arise from the last 16 months or so has been a lot of nonprofit arts organizations, perhaps maybe smaller to mid-size, begin to actually collaborate around fundraising. I wonder, from your perspective, from that kind of 10,000-foot level, is that an area where you see potential growth coming out of the pandemic?
That started a little bit before the pandemic, and like everything else, you know, with the pandemic, things get accelerated. I think it's also in response to our audiences, our staff, ourselves, you know, trying to be a little more discerning of where the funds that we're spending or we're receiving as a donation are coming from, right? And unfortunately, that means that the pool of fundings is going to shrink, hopefully not too much, and that we need to look for new ways of accessing, you know, the funding that sort of is aligned with the values and with the ethos of our organizations. And that combined with the idea of coming together in moments like the pandemic, you know, that coming together wasn't only about sharing ideas or resources. It was about, you know, let's work together, literally, right? And fundraising is part of that.
I hear you. And finally, I wanted to hear from you, maybe for you personally, what are you thinking about next? And sort of what are you envisioning as you move into the next phase?
You know, I'm sure you know this, and probably you asked this question, you know, my job ends at the end of the year. New mayor comes in and he'll appoint, you know, the commissioners that he would like to work with. If there's an opportunity to stay, I would love to stay. And somebody was telling me, you know, like, you know, when you live in New York and then you go anywhere else and New York have ruined completely the experience of living somewhere else and you're always going to be missing New York. I think this job does a little bit of that, you know, like just sort of the opportunity to see everything from that 10,000 sort of point of view, to be part of creating policy that would just help, you know, the whole sector or not just, you know, one organization. It's a little bit challenging to top in terms of, you know, excitement. But I'm open to see, I'm also very open to have, you know, a couple of months off. I have been working nonstop since I came to New York.
Well earned.
but then, you know, I'm open to see, you know, where things, we started the path to recovery. We're not quite there yet. I'm a little disappointed that we're falling in all sort of in the old normal. But then I realize it's the logic, you know, just to go back to what's familiar. But my hope is that then we take a moment to start thinking, you know, how do we change the things that became really evident during the pandemic? Would that be through policy making, through practice, through teaching and reflecting? I don't know, maybe a whole bunch of those, but I'm open to see a little bit where the chips fall in the future.
This has been really enlightening, and I really appreciate you sharing everything that you have. I think that question of arts policy in the United States is such a fascinating one. One sort of final question would be is, you mentioned that you do see things sort of reverting to the mean a little bit in terms of returning to normal. Do you see opportunities for fundamental shifts in arts funding at a national scale?
Absolutely. Again, we're going to have to work for that, and we're going to have to advocate for that, right? And we're going to have the leaders that really understand the importance of this work. But I do think there are opportunities to not only in the arts and culture sector, but in general in our society. We're at the brink of rethinking, you know, how we treat our workers. And there's a lot that we could contribute there and a lot that we could learn. There's opportunities of, you know, again, how do we engage with the sort of structural changes that happen demographically in our country, in our society, but also all the learning, the lifelong learning that we need to do in terms of racial justice and so many other issues. again, it's okay for a minute to go back to normal because that's what we know, but we're not going to be able to get away with it for too long because big changes are happening in our society and you can feel them, right? Not only we need to join the society in changing our sector itself, but it is my hope that we support artists to help us make sense of those changes and to make the work that continues to make us feel connected with our humanity.
I, for one, really like what Commissioner Casals has been doing over the last 18 months, and I'm excited to see what his next chapter will be. I know his schedule must be wild, so I appreciate him taking the time to speak with me today, and I hope you enjoyed it as well. Until next time, thanks for joining me at Informer, and I hope that you'll join us again.